Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the great frustrations in Oklahoma's criminal justice system is the glacial rate of change in the state's incarceration rate. This despite the Oklahoma Criminal Justice Reinvestment Act, which was passed some 5 years ago, which encouraged funding for treatment, services, and interventions rather than traditional incarceration. The passage of two state questions last year, again designed to reduce imprisonment rates. Earlier this week, there was a forum promoting four more bills for the upcoming legislative session that should produce further reform. And the need for this reform becomes even clearer with the Correction Department's proposed budget for next year, requesting $1 billion over this current year's budget. So how do we reduce incarceration rates, especially for females, where Oklahoma leads the nation in the number of women in prisons? A University of Tulsa law professor has a novel, if untried, approach. Professor Stephen Galoob and his students found a few existing but obscure provisions in existing Oklahoma law that could simultaneously provide a way to reduce this crisis and substantially improve the lives of some women in Oklahoma. He'll be talking about these provisions to legal professionals in the Richard Risk Practicum CLE series at the University of Tulsa. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Stephen Galoob, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you and some of your students have been working on sort of an issue related to female incarceration, and it's an affirmative defense for many people that might find themselves charged that has been overlooked in Oklahoma law. Can you explain a little bit about this?
That's right. I've been working with two of my really outstanding students, Cher Augusto, a recent graduate of TU Law School, and Megan Drake, who's a second-year law student. And one of the things that we found is that Oklahoma, as with many other states, has passed a very broad criminal prohibition on human trafficking. And when I say it's broad, what that means is that there are a lot of activities that you might not think in your mind's eye count as human trafficking, but that under the statute, they count. So any kind of coerced sex work or labor counts as human trafficking.
Now, I would think that second part is what you would consider the affirmative defense, using labor.
Right. So the affirmative defense comes in a different provision. So affirmative defenses are things like self-defense or insanity, where even though you are technically guilty of a crime or you technically meet all the elements that are necessary to be criminally liable, the state says it's not okay to punish you. And they can say that for a variety of reasons. Self-defense, it's because what we think is that you probably did the right thing. And insanity, we say something like, you are not the kind of person that we should be punishing. And so Oklahoma's human trafficking law has an affirmative defense for people who are victims of human trafficking. And what that affirmative defense does is it says, if you're a victim of human trafficking, then you're not liable for a crime. And the question, I think, that my students and I have sort of puzzled over is what exactly that means. If you look at it just on its face, what that means is that a lot of people who are victims of human trafficking should not be criminally liable for crimes. But there are many people who are in prison now or who are facing jail time who would meet this definition because, as I said before, it's a very broad definition of what counts as human trafficking.
So now, a majority of people that are in prison right now, the female population, would they qualify under a layman's definition of what human trafficking is, as opposed to what you're saying is the legal definition?
So I don't know. I think when I think of human trafficking, or in my sort of naive view, it involves not only coercing somebody, but bringing them in from someplace else to coerce them. That's the trafficking part. When we say drug trafficking, we don't mean people who are just selling drugs. We mean people who are bringing drugs in to sell them to other people. And so I think the tendency is to understand human trafficking in terms of bringing somebody else in from another state or from another
jurisdiction. We think of it in terms of the sex trade as well, right, too, right?
And that's not what Oklahoma's law does. There are federal human trafficking statutes that criminalize that. But Oklahoma, like a lot of other states, has passed a legislation that's based on a model from a nonprofit group called the Polaris Project. And that legislation that's passed in Oklahoma and a lot of other states doesn't require anybody to be imported to a different jurisdiction in order to classify what's happening as human trafficking. So to answer your question, I'm not sure. There are not very good statistics about the women's incarceration crisis in Oklahoma generally. And I'm pretty sure that there's not good statistical evidence about this particular phenomenon. But what I can say is that there are a lot of people who are in jail for drug abuse and for drug possession or drug distribution who have been forced into prostitution at some point in their lives, and potentially at the point when they were arrested. And under the way that, under the sort of obvious reading of the statute, they would qualify as victims of human trafficking, and so they would have an affirmative defense to the crimes that they're charged with. Mm.
Has anybody tried this out yet? Now, you wrote this memo to actually, I think there was a memo sent out to public defenders in the state. Has anybody tried to use this defense?
So I should say, I wasn't the one who wrote the memo. Yeah. My excellent former student, Cher Augusto, is the one who wrote the memo, with some help from me and one of my colleagues at TU Law School, Barbara Buckles. And we've been trying to reach out to nonprofit groups and to the public defender's offices in Tulsa and Oklahoma City. And as you might imagine, this is something that is a pretty complicated issue. I mean, we have our public defenders work very hard, and they don't have a lot of excess capacity to hear novel, potentially crazy theories by law professors. And so we haven't received a lot of uptake in our theory, but I think that there's some really good reasons to think that the theory, the reading of the statute that we've identified is the right reading of the statute.
Why would it be important to actually challenge this reading of the statute in court? Why would it be important?
I think the reason it's important is twofold. Number one, the statute provides an affirmative defense, like I said before. So what that means is that if the state can't disprove that somebody is a victim of human trafficking, then that person should not be convicted of a crime. Number two, the statute specifies a very, I think, progressive and forward-looking criminal procedure for people who are or who plead that they are victims of human trafficking. It's non-confrontational. The victim or the alleged victim is not supposed to go to jail. They're supposed to receive medical care and legal representation in excess of what we normally provide to people who are charged with crimes. The entire proceeding is supposed to be done in a kind of confidential way that would ensure the safety of the person who's pleading that they were the victim.
Again, these were all designed, I think, in intent to say a large criminal organization that's either importing women or putting women in a situation where they're being coerced into doing commercial sex activity or labor of some sort.
That's potentially a reading. Uh-huh. That's not what the statute says.
Says though.
Right. And it's not what the legislative history says. One of the things that's really interesting about this particular statute is that the Polaris Project's model statute, the one that I said Oklahoma's law is based on, has a restriction on the affirmative defense. It says you can assert this defense as a defense to any crime that's related to human trafficking. And the various states that have adopted this statute have incorporated that restriction.
Or maybe even made it a little tougher.
Yeah, absolutely. They've tightened it up. But Oklahoma went the opposite way. It said if you are the victim of human trafficking, then you have this defense, and it didn't restrict the crimes that you might have it for. Now, why might that be? This is, I think, the question that you and your listeners might want to know. And I think, one plausible explanation of this is that the legislature understood just how pervasive the effects of coerced labor and coerced sex work are. And just like we recognize some defenses in criminal law, for instance, the defense of duress, which essentially says when somebody coerces you, you are not fully legally responsible for your actions. The way that coercion works in human trafficking situations is pervasive and it's subtle, and it's hard to tell when somebody is actively being coerced or actively being threatened, because coercion and threats are just kind of part of the job description. Mm-hmm. And so the reasons that we might provide a more general and a broader defense to people who are victims of human trafficking is because the Oklahoma legislature understands just what human trafficking is.
That would be a really generous description of our Oklahoma legislature, because, you look at what's been happening over the last, almost 6 years now. I mean, there have been, the Oklahoma Justice Reinvestment Act has been passed. It's never been funded by the legislature, which would provide more money to high crime areas to really decrease the number of people that are actually incarcerated and look at other ways of community service or counseling to handle low-level crimes. And yet they've not funded any of that. Why do you think they're so generous on this particular issue?
I don't know. I'm not a legislative watcher. I'm sure you can get David Blatt or some other person who knows a lot about the Oklahoma legislature in here to tell you why that might be. I'm a lawyer, and what I do is I look at what the law says. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about what the law says is that it's not just me and my students who have signed off on this. The law has been interpreted by a special commission that's designed to, whose job is to figure out what the law means for the purposes of helping juries understand it. So it's called the Uniform Jury Instruction Commission. And the Uniform Jury Instruction Commission has established model jury instructions for this particular statute. And those model jury instructions say exactly what we think the law actually means, that the law provides an affirmative defense to people who are charged with a crime if they are victims of human trafficking.
So if they're victims of human trafficking, if they're accused of burglary, murder, yeah, arson, any crime, right?
There's not a restriction in the statute or in the jury instructions. And I think that the most important thing for people in your audience to hear, or one of the most important things, is that these jury instructions have been signed off on by the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals as at least a plausible way of understanding the law. And so it's not just, like I said, my brilliant students and their rather mediocre professor who think this. It's the Oklahoma Uniform Jury Instruction Commission and the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals who think this too.
So if this is out there, why hasn't anybody used this yet from your viewpoint?
Well, I would say by analogy, 401ks were out there for a long time before anybody discovered that 401ks are what we think that they are now.
Right.
So it's not that unusual to have a really forward-thinking provision be hidden in plain sight for a while. And sometimes you just need somebody to point it out, and then it becomes obvious in retrospect. In terms of the specifics, I would imagine as a criminal defense attorney in this state, it's hard enough to get your clients to cooperate with you, especially if they've been victims of human trafficking, that there might be a way in which the human trafficking experience disrupts your ability to confide or trust somebody else. And it also might, especially the way that many people understand it, it might raise anxieties about, am I going to get in trouble with the person who I really fear, which is the person who trafficked me, my pimp or the boss of the gang that I'm in or something like that.
Or my spouse,
right. And So the reasons why people might or might not utilize this defense, I don't know. But the fact is that the defense is at least colorable and it's at least plausible. And if it were used, it could do a lot of good. The women's incarceration crisis in the state is so problematic because it affects so many more lives than the lives of the people who are incarcerated.
We're talking families. We're talking generations, right?
And you might think that this is the problem with incarceration generally, but I think that it's specifically true with women's incarceration. And if there are a significant number, and again, I don't know the answer to this question, but if there are a significant number of people who are in jail, who are facing jail time, who might avail themselves of this defense, I think, you know, as a former practicing attorney, that it's on the people who are representing these folks to really advocate on their behalf and to use all the means that are available to them.
My guest today is Stephen Galoob. He's an associate professor of law at the University of Tulsa College of Law. He'll be speaking about this in the Richard Risk Practicum series coming up on Friday at noon for the legal community. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. So let's talk about the definition of what it means to be a victim of human trafficking. Is that a hard standard to meet here in the state of Oklahoma? Or could it apply to a lot of situations that might not match what a layman thinks about human trafficking?
That's a great point. I think the definition that the legislature has, as with many crimes, has a very broad kind of flowery definition and then more specific examples of what counts as a definition. So the definition that the legislature identifies is that human trafficking is a form of modern-day slavery that includes extreme exploitation and denial of freedom or liberty. And then it gives specific examples of what that means. One of the things that falls under that example is coerced sexual labor. Another is just plain old coerced labor. So when we talk about the way that the statute might apply to women, it actually might also apply to a lot of people who are not women, who are coerced into doing things for that they don't want to do, whether it's labor or participation.
Would that apply to sort of a drug dealer, drug user relationship?
You know, the weird thing about a law like this is that it's very broad and it's up to the courts and the way that we normally think about how law works out to figure out what the legislature actually means. And I think that the goal that my students and I have of spreading the word about this statute is that it's time for the legislature and the courts and the lawyers in Oklahoma to get working on this particular statute to try to figure out what exactly it means.
Let me throw it out of the specific to the abstract. When you have very broad definitions in any sort of lawmaking capacity, and when you're talking about criminal offenses and defenses against criminal offenses, that broadness means there's a whole range of interpretations that can be out there and what courts can do to interpret that law. Has this never come up in any sort of Oklahoma jurisprudence where the limits to what the legislature wrote and what they intended come up?
So there's a broad definition of the crime of human trafficking, and then there's a very broad application of the affirmative defense. In terms of whether the crime itself is prosecuted, yes, the crime, many offenses that otherwise could be classified in a less serious way are often charged as human trafficking offenses. For instance, you know, pimping, right, is a crime on its own, and then it's also potentially a crime under this human trafficking statute. The difference is that this human trafficking statute is a much more severe criminal penalty for essentially the same conduct. So prosecutors in Oklahoma, and I don't have, you know, definitive evidence on this, but I've talked to enough people to be pretty confident in my judgment, they're using this broad definition of the crime to punish people more than they might otherwise be punished. What we're suggesting is that prosecutors and defense attorneys alike are overlooking the very broad affirmative defense that applies to people who are victims of human trafficking. Hmm.
What's the next steps? Are you just waiting for a criminal defense lawyer to use this defense?
I think my students and I would both be really happy to work with anybody who's willing to assert a defense like this on behalf of their clients. We are also trying to just get the word out and to talk to people who might be in the legal community or affected by the kinds of unfortunate circumstances that would cause somebody to need to raise this defense. And I would love to talk and be whatever help that I could be to anybody who wants to make Oklahoma a more just place for women and girls.
Mm. You know, if you use this defense successfully, I know you're going to say I'm not a legislator, but do you think there would be a reaction to tighten up what these definitions are in the law?
The legislature in Oklahoma is pretty unpredictable, and there are some things about which they're not on the leading edge of progressivism. Right. But then there are some things, and I think when it comes to protecting victims of crime, there are some things that really resonate across the conservative and liberal divide. And I think the idea that people who've been victimized by crime throughout their life deserve not our condemnation, but our support. They need resources and rather than criticism and, you know, incarceration. That this is an idea that has a lot of resonance with people who are Republicans and people who are Democrats.
Yeah. Now, one thing you mentioned about this statute is that it's very much like the Criminal Justice Reinvestment Act's intent is taking away a lot of the, let's throw, put you in jail and lock you away, and let's figure out ways to change your conditions. And it basically was talking about moving money from the correctional system to community-based systems. It sounds like that's what's exactly in place in this when you're determined to be a victim of human trafficking.
And let me reiterate, it's not when you're determined to be a victim of human trafficking.
It's when you
assert that you are a victim of human trafficking. A whole host of procedural safeguards are supposed to kick in, one of which is that you're supposed to receive the medical care that's necessary for you to, and the psychological care that's necessary for you to get past the traumatic criminalization that you've been a victim of. One of the hard things in criminal law is looking at people who commit crimes and thinking about them as really as people and as people who might have been victimized throughout their lives.
Yeah, especially when they've been victimized all their life, they've probably been in for multiple offenses over time. They become a number, right?
I think there's a tendency in the criminal justice system to focus on the output, like you're in a factory
making widgets. The outcome, not the conditions that led to it.
Right. And so it doesn't really matter whether you've been criminally victimized your whole life, whether you grew up in circumstances that lead to criminogenic behavior, whether you grew up in more privileged circumstances. This defense is supposed to apply to people equally. And that, to me, is the really noble idea behind criminal law generally and behind this particular law, is that we can help people through the criminal law in ways that we might not be able to help them otherwise.
All right. Well, are there any other strategies out there to reduce the number of female incarcerations? As you mentioned, this is such a major problem because not only affects the incarcerated, but it affects the immediate family. It affects, any children that are involved and the home life of everybody involved.
One of the hardest things about a problem like this, which I'm certainly not an expert in, but I know enough to know how hard it is to try to resolve it. But one of the hardest things about a problem like this is that getting people out of jail is not the end of the story. That the story about how we got to this crisis and what the crisis actually does starts way before the moment when somebody is arrested, and it continues way after the moment when they're freed from state custody. And I think that the strategy can be part of a coordinated strategy. And your listeners are going to be really familiar with the truly innovative programs that are available in the Tulsa area, such as Women in Recovery, but there are hundreds of others.
There are a number of others.
That are designed to understand how big of a problem this is and how many modalities are needed to really address it.
All right.
If I could, one before we leave, I would like to just say hello, if it's okay, to my wife, Mindy Galoob, who's one of your biggest fans and a regular listener and who inspires me to work on behalf of women and girls in Oklahoma all the time.
All right. Well, you'll be talking about this Friday, and hopefully, I guess your students are still looking at other ways you can help the female incarceration as far as reducing the rate. Is that something your ongoing focus for you and your work?
Absolutely. It's something that I'm very interested in. And I think the social justice commitment at the University of Tulsa's College of Law is vital. And it's a big part of what we do. And I think all of us, and especially the really excellent clinical staff that we have, clinical faculty and staff that we have through the College of Law's several clinics, are all aiming to make Oklahoma a more just place for Oklahomans.
All right. Well, Stephen, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you
so much. Stephen Galoob is an associate professor of law at the University of Tulsa College of Law. He'll be giving a talk to legal professionals in the Richard Risk Practicum CLE series Friday at noon at the University of Tulsa College of Law. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
I knew all this Christmas music was driving me nuts, and now I know that I'm not the only one. The psychiatric community agrees with me. Some psychologists say the constant jingle, jingle, jingle of popular Christmas tunes is bad for our mental health, especially the poor people stuck working in retail stores who have to hear the fa-la-la-la-la loop all day long, over and over. Even without the music, according to the mental health experts, 61% of us are already stressed during the holidays. We feel pressured to do, buy, get, plan, and be, and every smell of pine cone, every vision of sugar plum decoration pounds the message home. But the worst is the relentlessly cheerful music. That's because music is the most emotional sensory prompt. Well, at first, secular Christmas music is cheerful, but that can go south fast and make us even more stressed. We try to tune it out, but that takes energy and exhausts us further. I don't mind Jingle Bell Rock, and I like Santa Baby, but the song that pushes me over the edge is The Little Drummer Boy, the ubiquitous Little Drummer Boy. Is there any singer who has not recorded The Little Drummer Boy? The answer is no. I looked it up. It was written by the American composer Catherine Kennicott Davis and first recorded in 1941 by the Trapp Family Singers. Well, I'd expect the Trapp Family to record it, and the Vienna Boys Choir, and Bing Crosby, and Andy Williams, and Rosemary Clooney, and they all did. But so did Johnny Cash, Marlene Dietrich, the Jackson Five, the Temptations, Ray Charles, and Jimi Hendrix recorded The Little Drummer Boy. So did Ringo Starr, Kenny G, and Bob Dylan. Christopher Lee recorded it, and he's an actor famous for his role of villains. The Little Drummer Boy has been recorded in Spanish, French, Finnish, and Punjabi. Will somebody make them stop? Well, evidently not, because it's one of the top 25 most performed Christmas songs. I can appreciate the story, a little boy who has nothing to give the baby Jesus but the simple gift of playing the drum. Well, wouldn't the sound of a drum scare a little baby? Wouldn't sleep-deprived parents go wild? The song repeats rup-a-pup-pum 21 times. It takes a saintly person to love that. This isn't a very holiday sentiment, but I hate the Little Drummer Boy. And the Little Drummer Boy hates me right back.
Connie Cronley is a writer and essayist and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.